Hello and welcome to a new episode of The Lee Show. It's nice to be back with you all. What a delight. I'm here with a wonderful guest, Jeff Schullenberger. Jeff is a professor at NYU. He is a columnist at Compact Magazine, and he has a website and podcast called Outsider Theory. I've read some of his stuff. I think he's brilliant and a great thinker, and I'm excited that he's here to join us today. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks. Thanks for the invitation.
It's very nice to have you here. So, you know, a lot of what you have written, it's what I would consider a sort of new right in a way. Stuff that you wouldn't have considered right wing 15 years ago. Sure. Stuff that 15 years ago would have been like mainstream liberal content. And now somehow there's been this shift. And I don't know if you read Scott Alexander's blog, Astral Codex 10, and he had a piece last week or this week in which he talked about the concept of these X-wing parties in America, and the idea that, you know, are we becoming more left-wing? Are we becoming more right-wing? What is the center? It depends, I guess, what you compare it to. But it was a very interesting concept, I think, to just think about. I've written in the past about this idea of like horseshoe theory, that like the far right and the far left are kind of the same thing. So I guess the question is, let's start with this. Is America more right wing, more left wing? And where do you feel like, do you feel like you've changed? Do you feel like you started out as left wing and then somehow the rest of the world moved around you? Like, how do you think about that?
It's a good question. I have a friend who is a professor in Switzerland, who's of a Marxist background, basically, in her formation, named Elena Lange. And, you know, she has this very provocative claim that the left is the ruling class, or the left is, you know, the left is the establishment. So, you know, there's something kind of paradoxical here, right, which is that historically the notion of the right was, you know, born out of the French Revolution, right? And this idea that you had essentially the people who were trying to, you know, preserve the status quo and keep things as close to how they were as possible and preserve the, you know, powers vested in the aristocracy, the church, and other kind of institutions of the establishment. And then you have the left, which was attempting to kind of erode those historically powerful institutions and, or simply destroy them, right, by guillotining all the aristocrats and, you know, and basically...
Right. I mean, the idea of conservatism was conserving, right? It was
exactly,
keeping things as they were. Right.
Right. And so I think what's a little bit paradoxical about the present is that in some ways, I would argue the left is heavily identified with the most powerful institutions of our society ideologically. So, you know, we're thinking about the media, we're thinking about the universities, we're thinking about, you know, the NGO sort of complex. And we're also thinking here about, you know, basically not simply the elected government, but the massive state bureaucracy that, you know, at this point is larger and some argue sort of far more influential than, you know, elected politicians. And so, you know, what I'm going to say is paradoxical here, that kind of, you know, tries to make sense of Elena's seemingly strange claim that the left is the ruling class, is that, you know, what's identified as left-wing or progressive ideology is most thoroughly ensconced in these incredibly powerful institutions, and most recently is, you know, embraced by corporate America. So, you know, we have this whole notion of woke capital, which, you know, would have seemed quite bizarre to, let's say, conservatives, you know, 10 years ago, even, although I think they were beginning to see kind of hints of this. So they were, you know, the right was sort of familiar with the idea that, you know, the I mean, as Nixon said a long time ago, and then J.D. Vance recently repeated, like, the universities are the enemy, the, you know, the media is the enemy, etc. So they were used to the idea that those institutions were essentially bastions of left-wing ideology. But, you know, what's new today is that Fortune 500 corporations, too, are all, you know, essentially checking all the boxes of the sort of, you know, various progressive causes that they support. You know, I received
just right. We saw Disney, right? How about Disney? Yeah. Like going, you know, going hard with over the past couple of months, and it's clearly creating some controversy.
Yeah,
I wonder. You know, I read about Coinbase and what they did, like 2 years ago, maybe, when they banned any discussion of politics at work. They said you can't talk about it on the Slack. I wonder why more companies haven't tried to do it, because I have to think it's a distraction. It probably alienates a lot of people. There are probably lots of folks who feel badgered into, you know, doing gender pronoun stuff that they wouldn't otherwise want to talk about. And then there are others who are doing it because they love it and they believe it. And so I sort of wonder, you know, I then contrast that, or not even contrast, I mean, that sort of dovetails with this obsessive focus on ESG investing. And I don't know how familiar you are with ESG investing, but like the idea that, you know, Larry Fink at BlackRock can dictate what is considered good social practices and that you're going to have this this emphasis on it, right? And it's ever changing. It's hey, weapons are bad, Raytheon is bad, but then we're in, you know, enmeshed in supporting Ukraine, and so it's like suddenly weapons are good and Raytheon is good, and so like there's not really an objective standard of what is ESG. It's a moving target there, and it feels very fake to me.
Right. And you know, it's so what's again sort of paradoxical about all of this is that, going back to this original idea that, you know, the right historically is that the forces that are attempting to conserve the institutions of the status quo, the left is what's trying to erode or overturn those institutions and create something new. I think, you know, in some ways we could argue, and this is again Elena's point, that things have flipped and that, you know, essentially left-wing ideology is at this point at least functionally conservative, because it is, you know, essentially being used to prop up all of these incredibly powerful institutions, right? And so, you know, so what does that mean? I'm not, you mentioned the notion of the new right. You know, I sort of have somewhat, you know, mixed views of that as a phenomenon. You know, I mean, there are different things it can mean. But, you know, what we are seeing is a very weird situation. And, you know, let me also mention a little bit of my background, which is, you know, maybe, you know, has led me to write about and sort of approach things from a sort of surprising angle, which is that, you know, I have this like academic humanities training, which means, you know, and particularly the realm of that I was in, meant that I was very immersed in critical theory, right? And in, you know, both sort of Marxist critical theory and sort of French post-structuralism and so on, right? So all these things that historically the American right and sort of centrist liberalism see as very corrosive and sort of damaging ideological influences, particularly in the university. You know, and that you still have people, you know, attacking in various ways today. But, you know, what's quite strange, and I guess a point that I've made in various ways, is that, you know, I actually a lot of the some of the critiques anyway that come out of this realm are extremely, I would say, kind of useful for understanding what's going on in terms of how power is functioning today, and particularly this kind of, you know, this sort of diffuse establishment that is infused with all of these, you know, progressive causes and ideals. You know, I really think a lot of these theories actually, you know, in some ways saw that coming and had certain insights into it. Now, you know, this led me to write a piece just on my site, Outsider Theory, I think right around the end of the Trump administration, that was kind of about the fact that there are all these odd figures on the sort of new right and the Trumpist right who actually have a kind of background in this type of theory and thinking. And so this seems kind of surprising, but you know, it actually makes sense, precisely because a lot of this theory was attempting to make sense of the new forms of power that were emerging kind of in the second half of the 20th century and that we're now seeing a culmination of. And so, you know, part of what we're seeing, you brought up horseshoe theory, are these kind of odd crossovers, right? Where, you know, certain ideas that would have seemed to have the most currency on the left are actually proving useful to the right. I mean, I think, you know, if you follow somebody like Chris Rufo, you know, he's pretty explicit that he's kind of influenced by sort of postmodernist cultural theory in terms of how he approaches his
he sounds his, very his work. Intellectual. So, I mean, I listened to him on a podcast with Andrew Sullivan like maybe 3 months ago or so.
Yeah.
And he comes across as incredibly thoughtful and intellectual. But he's also just like got one shtick, right? He's got one shtick and he just like hammers on that one shtick over and over and over without much variation or even he's like, I'm super well educated. I know a ton of stuff. I've read everything. Here's my shtick. I'm just going to say the same shit over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, I would say he's, and I mean, no, you know, shade with this necessarily. I mean, I have my sort of critiques of him, but you know, he's a very effective propagandist, right? And I think he's able to also
very much so.
He's also able to kind of theorize what he's doing, right? And how he's taking advantage of the way that the media functions today, right? So, you know, I think he again has sort of been clear that in a way he sees what he's doing as a kind of postmodern project, but one aimed at this kind of, you know, conservative agenda. So that's an example of that kind of crossover.
I would mark a certain subtlety in this, though, which is, and maybe I'm wrong about this, I'm curious what you think. I perceive there are folks like Rufo, and he is, of course, you know, very focused on this concept of critical race theory and talking about how dangerous it is and teaching it in school is dangerous. There are folks who I think take one issue or multiple issues and then say, here is what I think about it. Here's where I stand on this issue. And then there are other folks who start with a more tribal sort of approach to things where they say, I am a Republican and it's all about Team Republican. And then they pick issues that maybe fit under that Republican platform, or maybe they're the trailblazers on certain issues, but it's much more tribalist. Whereas if I think about some folks, it's like, here's the issue that I care about, and it's not about Team Republican or Team Democrat. You know what? And I guess there's pros and cons to either one. It's hard to be effective in a two-party country. It's hard to govern effectively if you're just focused on specific issues. Like, you need some sort of consensus and team building there. But on the other hand, it feels like otherwise you end up defending the Republicans because they're the team I'm on, or and that's sort of a weird thing. How do you think about that distinction and where people can be effective and you know, who you've seen do either one well?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. You know, I would also say that, you know, the other thing that, and this doesn't necessarily answer the question, so perhaps we can get back to it. But, you know, I'm pretty uninterested in, you know, party politics. You know, like I really, you know, going back to what I was saying before, I think the analysis of power today, and of how power works sort of has to transcend the sort of party binary, or it's just going to be ultimately, it's just going to be very limited in its insights. And, you know, a simple explanation of that is just that, you know, look at, I mean, one thing that was very clear in the Trump years, and, you know, I think it was definitely a period where my sense of what was going on, and I think many other people's, you know, really shifted, you know, was that a great deal of what had been the sort of Republican establishment, you know, essentially defected to the other side because there is this kind of cross-party, you know, sort of power elite that, you know, whether to whatever extent this was a correct analysis, saw him, you know, saw what Trump was doing or threatening to do as a sort of threat. And so, you know, that that sort of closing ranks, you know, just shows that, you know, that there's a real there's a kind of deeper level at which all of this is operating, and to some extent, you know, a great deal of the sound and fury is kind of secondary to what's really going on.
Look, so, I mean, I see someone like Ben Shapiro, who Ben Shapiro is funny and he's a talented writer and speaker and he does a great job. But I see Ben Shapiro as a party first and versus ideas first guy. And
I see what you mean. Yeah.
You know, there's a distinction in there. And I also find partisan politics to be very boring. I sort of define myself as anti-partisan or non. I think that's even more extreme than nonpartisan. Like I think of myself as, you know, I want to take every issue and parse it and say, here's the ones I care about. Here's what I'm interested in. And then there's a bunch of stuff that I just don't care about. But I also, you know, I just recognize that that's not necessarily the most effective thing in America.
Yeah.
Right now, you know, when you think about this new, this concept of the new right, and of course, you know, you and I discussed momentarily the James Polk piece in Vanity Fair about this, and I think, you know, for those who are listening who haven't read it, it's a very important article. You know, here's my first question for you about this is let me take a step back. When I was 15, I had a crush on a girl named Liz, and she was reading The Fountainhead, and I wanted to kiss up to her, and so I read The Fountainhead, and then I read Atlas Shrugged, and I was, you know, I was 15, I was very suggestible, I became totally brainwashed, and thankfully I pivoted, and then I read other authors who were more thoughtful and had more subtlety in their work, and more humane, and, you know, just switching and reading like Victor Hugo, thankfully, just changed my perspective after reading Ayn Rand. So the first question I'll ask you is, do you think Ayn Rand is the intellectual forefather of everyone on this new right? Like when you read that James Pogue article, do you think every single one of those people, the most formative book for them was Atlas Shrugged? No matter how intelligent or sophisticated they are, do you think that's the most formative book for every single person? Because that's my guess.
That's an interesting question. You know, so let me go to the one who I kind of know the most about, which is Peter Thiel. So, you know, who's generally understood to be, you know, kind of the sort of primary patron of this whole realm, both in the world of politics with, you know, figures like J.D. Vance and Blake Masters, both of whom are, you know, closely associated with him in previously in their business careers, right? Both like worked in Thiel Enterprises and now are sort of his, you know, kind of handpicked sponsored candidates who are, you know, essentially supposed to represent this new right. Now, Peter Thiel, so first of all, you know, your question about Ayn Rand is really interesting in relation to, say, you know, I remember when Paul Ryan was sort of the hot young figure in the Republican Party, right? And I think the story was like he made all of his staffers read like the complete works of Ayn Rand or whatever. So there is this long-standing idea that, you know, if you're a sort of conservative, if you're a like bright young conservative, that's, you know, just it's your textbook. So Thiel is interesting because he was, by his own account, very influenced by Ayn Rand, right? But at the same time, he also, you know, I think sort of, you know, I mean, and I, as I recall, by his own account, has a sort of complex relation to Ayn Rand because he also became interested in these other thinkers, right? for whom individualism, you know, because Ayn Rand is fundamentally a sort of individualist, right? Her entire philosophy is based around the idea that, you know, we need to kind of empower these strong individuals to, do great things that will ultimately, you know, the sort of benefits of which will ultimately trickle down to everyone else. And anyone who would try to restrain or, rein in their, these great deeds on the part of these strong, ambitious individuals is sort of ultimately a kind of resentful, figure it's a very kind of, it's a version of sort of Nietzscheanism, right? It's this idea that there are basically the strong and the weak, and, you know, liberalism, right, which tries to kind of restrain the strong and favor the weak is a politics of resentment, right? Now, you know, Thiel himself is, you know, was influenced by that, right? And in a sense, his kind of entrepreneurial ethos was informed by it. But at the same time, he, you know, became particularly interested in the philosopher René Girard, right, who he knew at Stanford and who I, you know, have written quite a bit about. Who is in a way sort of the opposite of this, right? Because for Girard, individualism is kind of a myth because all of us are mimetic. In other words, we're imitative. And what that means is that, you know, the idea that there are certain individuals who are, you know, these kind of strong-willed creators of their own destiny is for Girard a sort of modern myth, right, that blinds us to the way that we are influenced by others and the way that we are necessarily going to be imitative of others, right? And so this is what Girard calls the romantic lie. So, I mean, what's interesting about Thiel is that he sort of has these two poles of his thinking, one of which is Ayn Rand and the other of which is Girard. And Girard is really, never commented directly on Rand, but could be seen as almost an opposite figure in his whole philosophy. So, going back to your previous point.
I mentioned Victor Hugo versus Ayn Rand, and obviously they're different writers, but same kind of concept, right? That you can be very influenced by two folks that on totally opposite ends of this spectrum. Yeah.
So, you know, going back to your point, I would see Ayn Rand as kind of the patron saint of a sort of older sort of Reaganite republicanism, which is all about entrepreneurial individualism and the need to, kind of empower individuals by cutting their taxes and, you know, and so on to, innovate and, build businesses and things like that. And, you know, I suppose what's interesting about the new right is that they're, I think, quite internally divided. Because, you know, part of what's new about it is that it claims to represent a kind of break with this earlier form of sort of Reaganite republicanism, right? Because it claims to be invested in some kind of notion of, it's often very Catholic, right? It's often this kind of like notion of the common good, right? That, you know, there's something greater than there, or there's something that politics needs to do other than just kind of empower these strong individuals to do great things that the rest of us can benefit from. Instead, that it needs to, you know, and if you think of somebody like Vance, it needs to attend to social problems that are created as a result of you know, capitalism, right? In other words, you know, it needs to, take up a certain social responsibility. Right.
And I mean, you can make an argument here that I've said this in my writing and in the show in the past. You could make an argument that in 2001, the Clinton administration finally got China into the WTO at the request of business leaders who had been lobbying hard for this because they saw it as a major profit generating opportunity. And as a result, we spent the next 20 years shipping jobs to China en masse, that we devastated entire factories and companies and towns as we tore them apart and shipped jobs away. And I would argue that it is not a coincidence that we had a fentanyl epidemic at the same time, that we had an opiate epidemic at the same time, and that we sort of stuffed people full of painkillers and said, you can go fuck yourself and die now, and we've sent your job to China without any sort of safety net for you. And, you know, that's the problem with that sort of Randian capitalism, is that you're relying on these great figures, but they can often do things that are really harmful to everyone else in the pursuit of their own prosperity.
Right, exactly. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you take someone like Vance, you know, he essentially claims that, you know, things like the fentanyl crisis, right, which are affecting his home state of Ohio very severely, you know, are things that the state has to, like, it can't just kind of let the free market solve it, right? It has to kind of intervene in some way. So, you know, to some extent, this represents a break with this more kind of libertarian, individualist, kind of pro-business philosophy that I would associate with Rand, right? But so interestingly, on the economic level, I think the new right is sort of, you know, attempting something like a break from this this earlier, you know, sort of more hyper-libertarian sensibility. But I think that's also ambiguous, right? And I don't, you know, I'm still not sure exactly what, you know, in policy terms that adds up to. But then, you know, the other thing that's sort of interesting here is that there's kind of the political and sort of electoral side of this set of developments. And then there's the sort of cultural side of it, right? And here, I think, I mean, this is, you know, I some years ago, I went to this, there's this, I believe, a Dutch or Belgian director, Ivo van Hove, theater director, and he made this kind of, you know, extremely, you know, kind of shocking and stunning, you know, theatrical production of The Fountainhead, which you mentioned before. And he, you know, when it came to the US, it was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, right? So it was kind of interesting to go to, because it was like this production of Ayn Rand being performed for the sort of Brooklyn bourgeoisie, you know, which is generally as hostile as one could be.
Right.
To Ayn Rand.
That's not a friendly audience, yeah. One would think.
Yeah. So anyway, I went to that. It was kind of interesting. But, you know, if you read the sort of liner or the, you know, the playbill, like the brochure, it had Van Hove's sort of explanation of what he was trying to do with this. And he said, you know, I don't agree with Ayn Rand in politics, but in the realm of art, I think she's absolutely right. Right. That there are simply these kind of, you know, strong geniuses. Right. And the only way to have good art is to essentially, you know, give them the freedom to do great things. Right. And so he sort of argued that, you know, at least in the realm of the arts, this kind of Randian philosophy of like radical individualism and freedom is the necessary sensibility. And I do think, you know, in the kind of cultural realm of the new right, which is very ambiguous, and, you know, I mean, because it's so outside of any cultural institutions, like it's completely, you know, it's completely excluded from all cultural institutions, right, which are entirely dominated by, you know, sort of left liberalism. And so, you know, it's a very weird phenomenon. A lot of self-published books, a lot of podcasts, a lot of, you right. know, just kind of these new realms of cultural production that are outside of institutions. But, you know, there are some, you know, recent things that have come out of this that are kind of interesting. This journal called IM1776 is one that produced a very fine, aesthetically nicely presented print issue recently. There's this thing called the Passage Prize. So anyway, there are these like attempts to kind of foster a realm of of sort of cultural creativity that's largely, you know, expressed in dissent. Or my friend Adam Lehrer has this podcast Substack called Safety Propaganda, which I'd sort of link with this, although he's kind of a Marxist, but, you know, has a lot of kind of connections to new right sort of figures. But, you know, it is really
you could argue like Freddie DeBoer and other folks like that who, you know, call themselves socialists or Marxists, and yet they're writing, if you took out the sentence that says, I am a Marxist, it's otherwise not that distinguishable from others who are on this sort of new right, whether it's Wesley Yang, whether it's, you know, maybe you could say Mike Solana, who is who works for Peter Thiel and is a very gifted writer. You know, you could argue that their writing is not that distinguishable other than Freddie DeBoer going, I'm a socialist. Otherwise, it's kind of the same thing.
Right. And so, but, you know, so just to sum up what I'm trying to get at, I think there's actually an attempt to turn away from kind of Randian individualism and libertarianism in the realm of politics and propose something different. You know, and in some cases, something more like a kind of, you know, European, something like a sort of, you know, European, like conservative social democracy or something like that. But in the realm of culture, I think there's this kind of, you know, rejection of the kind of censoriousness and the kind of moralism of, you know, the sort of left dominated cultural institutions, and the attempt to vindicate a kind of, strong individualist ethic of sort of unrestrained creativity, right? And a kind of amoralism and even sort of libertinism that, you know, I think is somewhat, and I think these two things are somewhat in tension, right? Because basically, you know, to try to sum this up, you know, when I was growing up, I mean, I guess, like, you know, I was a teenager in the 90s. I think, you know, there was still basically this idea that, you know, being sort of culturally on the left meant being in favor of free expression and against censorship. And obviously all that has changed, right? You know, basically the left is kind of at the forefront of demanding censorship, restrictions on creativity, and that also, you know, artistic creativity should kind of serve some kind of political messaging end, right? And so instead what you have
you,
is
have you, you know, just to your point that you made just a second ago, have you been reading about what's been going on with Felicia Sanmez at the Washington Post over the past week? I mean, you mentioned this sort of censorship and libertinism. You know, I can guess where you come out on this, but as I was thinking about it last night, I on the one hand, she's clearly being very disruptive in the newsroom and is, you know, maligning her colleagues in public. And on the other hand, it's not crazy to say, I don't love the idea that my colleagues are retweeting stupid, but, you know, vaguely sexist jokes. That's not like if he said that joke in the middle of the workplace, you wouldn't say, oh, yeah, that's okay. Like, that's a thing that we've kind of decided as a society is not an appropriate thing to do. And I don't think you have to be very censorious to say that's not an appropriate thing to do in the workplace. You know, what's interesting is there's been discussion a little bit in the press of how she sued the Washington Post last year, and she lost the case. So I dug in a little bit about what that case was about. And she had declared publicly that she was a survivor of sexual assault. And the Washington Post then prevented her, they forbade her from covering any stories about sexual assault because they said that she would not be able to be unbiased, that she would be biased in her coverage, which I don't know. Is it a given that you would be biased in your coverage? And is it also crazy to say that they are somehow restricting her job duties because of this? I don't know that being a survivor of sexual assault puts you in some kind of a protected class that's not race or something, but it's an interesting concept. It doesn't strike me as so apparent that she was a nut. It doesn't strike me as somehow she was totally off base. Now, I think most people would disagree with me, but I didn't look at this and go like, wow, she seems really terrible. I'm glad, you know, bye Felicia. I'm glad they got rid of her. So I don't know. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's it's definitely an interesting, you know, sort of manifestation of a lot of these themes that we've been discussing. So, you know, first of all, I mean, there are a few dimensions of it, right? One of them is that it's kind of this, the way that, you know, workplace conflict becomes public in the realm of Twitter in particular, because it's this kind of journalistic water cooler space. And so, you know, part of what's strange about it, that's, you know, entirely a product of like the last 10 years or so, is that, you know, this thing that might have previously been adjudicated, and, you know, I mean, it's the kind of thing that often is adjudicated today in other industries, in, let's say, the HR department, you know, or the Title IX office in a university, is essentially, you know, becomes a kind of a subject of public discussion, right, and recrimination. And, you know, that's because she chooses to make it, or at least, you know, this time, as you pointed out, the previous, you know, she also previously sued the Washington Post. I believe that lawsuit was dismissed. I mean, so as far as the specifics of that lawsuit, you know, I think it, I mean, there are a few things that I think what this all has to do with is like, what does it mean to be a journalist now? Or what are the expectations of this profession? You know, there's some kind of older version of this that would be, you know, that you're supposed to be in a, you know, that there's a kind of ethic of, I suppose, a kind of unbiased, you know, dedication to like unbiased reporting, right? And, you know, that, you know, is expressed in the idea of a split between like the newsroom and the sort of editorial side of things, right? And so, you know, when you're on a news beat, you're not supposed to editorialize, right? Supposedly, right? And this is the historical institutional split, right? That these two are not supposed to be mixed. Now, you know, there are a few things that militate against that, one of which is the way that journalists who, you know, 20 years ago, you would have seen their bylines, but you wouldn't have really known much about them as people because they didn't really have any way to like put their lives on public display. And now that they do, of course, it's very easy to find out what their opinions are on things, right? And so, you know, the result is that if they're reporting, then even if, you know, ostensibly this reporting still follows this stricture, right, that, you know, reporting shouldn't involve editorializing, we also know what they happen to be tweeting about. And so, you know, that the idea that we're just kind of blissfully ignorant of their, you know, whatever their political beliefs might be is no longer sustainable, right? And then this is also expressed in this idea of, you know, moral clarity, right? That that basically, you know, this reporter, Wesley Lowery, you know, had this piece, I think, during the kind of summer of the George Floyd protests, that, you know, that reporting should not be understood as a kind of morally neutral, or it should not be understood as a sort of politically neutral activity, but, you know, and instead should reflect moral clarity. In other words, you know, when there's a clear kind of moral cause at stake, then the reporting, there should be no sort of taboo against the reporter, you know, showing a clear preference in favor of the moral cause that they see as right and justified. And in that case, let's say the protests against police killings. So, you know, so again, there's both just a way that this has played out as a function of the spilling of journalism onto social media, that now reporters are not just kind of names you see above an article, but they're personalities.
Right. They're personalities, and they're big personalities in many cases. They're very public.
Yeah.
Personalities. They're minor celebrities in many cases, or at least in certain circles.
Yeah,
I guess they are. But, you know, you You, one of the things that you mentioned earlier and that we'd wanted to talk about today was this concept of elite overproduction. And yeah. I perceive that you would probably, correct me if I'm wrong, you'd probably classify most of these reporters you're talking about as coming from this elite class.
Yeah.
And so there's this idea of elite overproduction, and implicit in that idea is that there is a scarce number of sort of elite spots available, and we're making too many, and there's not going to be anything for them to do, right? That we're graduating too many top people from top universities. There's going to be nothing for them to do, and that's somehow a bad thing. And what I would take issue is the idea that the demand is constrained, the idea that this these spots for elites is constrained and therefore you can overproduce them. I don't think that's a thing. I think having a more educated population is a good thing. Now, we can debate what is a good education, right? Does it, if you crank thousands and thousands of people through degree programs teaching them bullshit, that's, you're not creating elites, you're creating a bunch of dummies, right? That are, they've spent years in a classroom learning shit that's not useful. But I don't think that it is constrained. I think the more educated people you create, the more they're going to create, and the more you are going to create room for those elites. So I take issue with the concept of elite overproduction. But I mean, you've written about this topic. You're a lot better informed on it than I am. Like, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think I basically agree with your critique. So this idea comes out of this this Russian-American historian, Peter Turchin, who's actually originally a biologist, I believe. And so he has a very, you know, kind of distinct and somewhat eccentric approach to history, which is very much, you know, driven by kind of, or grounded in kind of attempts at mathematical modeling and, you know, trying to understand patterns of history that you can observe kind of across different periods, right? And so his argument is that, you know, if you want to understand like how societies become or enter into periods of instability, you know, whether that's the French Revolution, whether that's now, I mean, I think we could actually debate, because I think there's sort of a question of how we define instability. But you know, let's say something like what happened in 2020 at least look kind of unstable. So then the question is, you know, what are the underlying factors that explain this? So Turchin argues that basically, you know, and this goes against, say, like a Marxist idea that, you know, basically you have these kind of restive masses of like the working class that eventually kind of get fed up and revolt. You know, the argument is essentially that where the action really lies is in the sort of upper echelons of society, and that, you know, at a certain point, I mean, his argument is really that there is a kind of mathematical equation, right? That you know, as societies kind of expand and grow economically, there's a tendency for them to produce more and more elites, right? And that eventually the production of these elites kind of outstrips the ability to give them a sort of, I don't know, satisfying position in life.
Right. There can be this temporary idea that the production is going to outstrip the ability to absorb them. I'm not sure I agree with that.
Yeah. I'm not sure I do either. I mean, it's worth reading.
It's a myth of scarcity, right? And that's, yeah. To me, I think there's a connection between that and the concepts around immigration and the idea of there is a scarce amount of resources. Why are we letting immigrants into the country? They're taking the resource, right? That feels like a little bit of the same argument, that there is scarcity. And I'm not convinced that there's scarcity. I think you can create these virtuous cycles where more creates more.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I agree fundamentally that, you know, it ultimately gets very tricky, because I mean the other point I would make here is that you know, what is the entity that is scarce? If we're claiming that it's essentially income or, you know, remuneration, then obviously if you have a growing, you know, if you have an expanding economic pie, then it can be divided up in a way that, you know, there can be a sort of non-zero sum competition, right? Where, you know, the competition generates a kind of growth that then, and then, you know, right. this is the basic
point. This concept of zero sum versus non-zero sum. Yeah, right. Excellent
and
point.
So I have some, I mean, I agree, like I'm not a Turchinite. I think there's some value to it simply in the sense that at least in a localized way, it does kind of make sense. And, you know, if we just look at certain industries, I mean, including my own academia, right? It's very clear that there are simply, you know, that academia like is producing too many people with PhDs in relation to the number of, you know, positions with full-time employment that it's offering. Now, this is not the result of some kind of natural process, right? And this is why I agree with you that, you know, there's no kind of underlying scarcity here. What's going on is that there are kind of political choices being made in terms of how universities are run that are creating this dynamic. And we could look at, you know, journalism as well, right? Where basically you have, you know, and like, this is something that Matt Taibbi has written about Batya Ungar-Sargon has written about, that like journalism was historically not, it wasn't necessarily a very prestigious job, right? It was kind of a, it was like a solid kind of workaday job. Right?
It was a slog though. It was not always the, I went to Harvard and I'm a glamorous intellectual. It was the like, I drink and smoke too much and I've got some sources that I met at the bar and
I hang around City Hall and then I talk to the, you know, the sort of disgruntled staffers who feed me, you know,
I'm a police detective, but I know how to write kind
exactly.
of job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I think, Taibbi and you know, some other people have written about this, say that, you know, one thing that happened was like Watergate and like All the President's Men and so on. So there's kind of this glamour that suddenly gets attached to journalism, and this starts to attract more people from these kind of, you know, from elite, you know, from like Ivy League institutions and so on to this career, right? And so, you know, it is, and again, you know, what you have is sort of a collision course here where, you know, because of technological changes, it becomes harder to sustain things like investigative reporting because of the way that these publications make money. And also that you have, you know, a kind of, you know, because of these factors, you have a kind of dying off of like local newspapers, right? So you have a kind of immense concentration of journalistic resources in like the New York Times, Washington Post, and a couple of other major outlets. And then you have this kind of hollowing out of local publications that used to be really the, you know, the place where in this older system you would kind of, you know, make your career as a journalist, right? And even if you ended up at the New York Times or somewhere else, like you would sort of cut your teeth and, you know, smaller cities kind of just doing this kind of, you know, as you said, this kind of slog of workaday reporting, right? And so whereas now there's kind of this different pipeline, you know, which is basically you go to an Ivy League school, you end up kind of fed into these elite journalistic establishments. You know, you probably do like an unpaid internship at some point. And, you know, what this, and in this case, there is in a specific way, a kind of hyper-competitive environment around the media because there are simply, you know, it has so much appeal and prestige as a profession, but it simply doesn't. And again, this is partly because of technological shifts. It's partly because of political choices. It's not just some kind of natural scarcity, but it is a situation where you have a kind of dearth of career opportunities for in relation to aspirants, right? So you have a kind of lopsided ratio. And, you know, you have an industry, both in the case of academia and in the case of journalism, where on one hand, there's a kind of concentration of wealth and power at the sort of at a handful of institutions. And then at the same time, you have draining away of resources from, you know, less elite kind of regional universities and newspapers, right? And so this does create this kind of pressure cooker environment. And this, I think, you know, I agree with you that, like, I don't know, you know, I think the question of, like, whether the Washington Post was right to ban Sanmez from doing that reporting is, you know, it's kind of an interesting question. I mean, Michael Tracy, who, you know, has kind of written some things critical of her, nevertheless, like, also said the same, that, like, he wasn't sure, you know, he thought that was, like, a complicated and interesting question and didn't think the Washington mm-hmm. Post was necessarily right about that or that she was necessarily wrong. But, you know, what you do see here is this kind of the way that these kind of political projects, you know, whether sort of Me Too or racial justice or, you know, the kind of radicalization of people in these fields who are basically elite educated sort of aspirants does seem to be linked in some way to the sort of hyper-competitive, situation in which there at least feels like there is a sort of zero-sum competition around a declining number of, you know, career paths within these fields. And so that...
Right. It's easy to feel scarcity when you're in it if you're not getting the thing that others have, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, you talked about Girard, and I know you've written extensively about Girard. You know, when you see others who are attaining fabulous success, whether it's material or professional or it's esteem of others, we want to mimic that. And, and you know, so we pursue these sort of academic things and think, okay, now this is the mold I want to follow and I'm going to be that person. And when you don't achieve that, and of course the grass is always greener, and everyone else is going to seem better by comparison. When you don't achieve that, it's easy to go, well, it's not fair. They're making too many elites. But, like, I'm not convinced at all that's what it is. You know, it's interesting you mentioned Girard. Like, mimicry is certainly a hot topic now in neuropsych. And the idea that the brain mimics others' actions with mirror neurons is certainly a hot topic. Mimicry in general, I think, is an interesting concept. I was thinking about it in the context of there are, and I don't know if this is true or if this is just like a thing that people write about because it sounds scary, but there's certainly people who write about this epidemic of kids who declare themselves trans because there's like a popular kid in the class, there's a popular girl in the class who says, I'm trans. And then suddenly, like, every other girl in the grade also says, I'm trans. I mean, what would Rene Girard have to say about the idea that being trans could be an epidemic or that this is all based on mimicry? Like, what do you think Girard would have to say about this idea?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you know, so the term that's often used in these discussions is social contagion. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it seems to me very strange that people would deny that this is, I mean, it's not strange, right? It politically makes sense, but, you know, it just seems obvious that these kind of things happen. And that anybody who's been around, particularly young people who are trying to kind of find their models and figure out, you know, their place in the world, right? And they're kind of looking around sort of horizontally to identify people who can give them some kind of orientation, right, in their peer group. You know, this just seems like it obviously happens, right? It happens in ways that, you know, in the past might have just involved, like, I mean,
it happened to me, right? Reading The Fountainhead because I saw someone reading The Fountainhead. Like, it's for sure we can all imagine it. I mean, my daughter is 11 and she has her last day of school today. And she and her friends were all texting this morning about what they would wear to school. And they're all wearing blue tops and white skirts. Like they, mm-hmm. and they don't have a uniform. They just, mm-hmm. and they all happen to have the same thing and they all just want to mm-hmm. look similar, right? They don't, nobody's looking to stand out here and blaze their own trail. We don't have any, like, you know, I think, you know, there's the term Sigma types, right? Where there's yeah. like the alphas and the betas and then the sigmas are the ones who just like go blaze their own trail. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about people who just want to fit in.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you know, Girard, he did write a book about anorexia, you know, in later in his career, you know, which I think, you know, you can certainly find similar dynamics around, you know, and if you, I don't know if you've come across some Default Friend, but, you know, she's kind of written some stuff about how, you know, at the same time on Tumblr in particular, that you had the kind of initial flowering of this whole, you know, now very Baroque field of sort of gender identity and so on, that you also have this kind of pro-anorexia movement where there was basically these people who like openly embraced, or, you know, basically girls who openly embraced anorexia and like tried to encourage others to do the same. So, you know, I think there are certainly plenty of other historical examples that are similar or comparable.
So before we wrap, we're coming up on the hour mark. Before we wrap, I wanted to leave with a fabulous quote. We talked about Ayn Rand today, and there's a quote attributed to John Rogers. I don't know who John Rogers is, but the quote is, "There are two novels that can change a bookish 14-year-old's life, The Lord of the Rings and Atlas Shrugged. One is a childish fantasy that often engenders a lifelong obsession with its unbelievable heroes, leading to an emotionally stunted, socially crippled adulthood, unable to deal with the real world. The other, of course, involves orcs."
Yeah.
And in the context of what we've just discussed, I mean, that's,
yeah.
I think that describes a lot of folks, you know, in this sort of new right, which I say that both wanting to be thought of that way, but also not wanting to necessarily associate myself with that and finding lots of things that I would pick at. You know, you mentioned that you have, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, of course, Thiel is also a big Tolkien person,
right.
You know,
he, right. He's into both.
In fact, yeah, exactly. Because he named Palantir the, you know, the right. sort of the, you know, one of his major companies is the name is a Tolkien reference. So,
right.
You know,
he went all in on both of those books.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you write a piece called Outsider Theory. Where can people find you? What are you promoting, if anything? Like, if people say, "I love this, this is so fascinating, I want to go listen to more," where do they go find you, and what would you love them to spend their money on?
I mean, I would definitely say check out Compact Magazine. It's a pretty new magazine. It's, you know, it's basically a sort of monthly subscription kind of thing. It's, I mean, it's entirely online, but, you know, it's like a Substack. You know, you would basically get a daily article, and some of those are by me, and it's just generally an interesting place with people from divergent sort of political perspectives, but all of whom are trying to, you know, think through the problems of the present in like new and fresh ways. You know, beyond that, you can find some of my writing at Unheard, which is another online magazine, and also at, and some longer form pieces at American Affairs, which is a print publication people could subscribe to. Pretty, you know, long, detailed, a lot of policy analysis, but also kind of cultural and historical coverage. So American Affairs, and I have a piece in the most recent issue on the philosopher Ivan Illich. And also The New Atlantis, which is a journal of technology and society, which is also a print print journal that, you know, published a lot of interesting people thinking about technology in the contemporary world. So I guess those are my regular places I contribute to.
That's your regular spots.
So yep. check all those out, and they're all worth subscribing to.
What are your regular publications that you read? Like, what can you not do without? Not Substacks. Mm-hmm. We can talk about Substacks another time. What are the pieces or the publications that you cannot live without in your daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly life?
That's a good question. I mean, I would actually say I read, you know, the publications that I just mentioned that I write for are also ones.
Those are the ones you read, right?
That I read very, you know, religiously. So I think, you know, those are all kind of great places to go.
At least you're aligning yourself then, right? You're sort of talking the talk, which I think is a good sign. Like I read The Economist and The New York Review every week and or biweekly, and I love those. I've never written for either of them, so I can't claim the same creds that you have.
Yeah, I read I guess I mean I read The New York Review of books. Some I read Harper's. I read I think that. I mean, the New Left Review on the left is a pretty interesting publication, publishes a lot of good people. On the right, I think, I mean, the American Conservative, I've written just a little bit for them. I think the New Criterion for sort of cultural and basically cultural coverage of, you know, the arts. It's, you know, kind of a conservative publication, but just very solid, you know, reviews of exhibits and books and performances and so on. So those are the main ones I'd think of. Yeah.
That's a good roundup. Well, we're bumping up against the hour mark here. Thank you again, Jeff. Again, you can find him and his writing at the publications he mentioned, at his blog and podcast, Outsider Theory. You can find him on Twitter. On Twitter, you are, what do you call yourself? The Daily Barbarian, is that right?
Yeah, it's just at Daily_Barbarian.
Daily_Barbarian. And of course, you can find more of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, wherever else you find your podcasts. And as always, LeeBressler.substack.com to sign up for the distribution list. Thank you for joining us, Jeff, and thank you to our listeners for listening, and we'll be back with more soon.
Thanks.